That is awesome. Awesome. I tell you, I'm hopeful that strategically placed at the end of this teaching series on how to lose your religion is our next big splash in 2 weekends. And it is our absolute prayer that there will be a lot of hundreds, literally hundreds, who are ready to say, I'm ready to lose my religion and enter into a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I'm going to dedicate that through the waters of baptism. So if that's something that God has placed upon your heart, and 2 weekends, big splash. Guest services is going to come forward right now. We're going to receive our evening offering, and we're going to thank you in advance for sharing. And if you're a guest here, it is our tradition to say, please just let this those baskets kind of pass on by you, and consider this as our gift to you. We love it that you're here. And we're, by the way, if you're here tonight, with that wind out there, I'm not sure I would be here if I weren't speaking. That is horrible out there. That's just really just brutal. So thank you for braving the wind and for all the other stuff you've had to face to get here tonight. So I'm glad you're here, and this is a great opportunity. I want you to meet a couple friends of mine, and their pictures are going to be on the side screen. Names Aaron and Libby Charlton. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit of their story. This is Aaron and Libby. And I met them 3 years ago on a February. They were standing in the atrium, and I didn't recognize them. And so I just walked up and introduced myself to them and found out a little bit of their story. And I didn't know if they'd been a long time coming to Southbrook, and I just hadn't seen them, or if they were relatively new. I said, well, this is actually our second weekend here. I said, well, that's great. I said, tell me a little bit of your story. So they began to share me their story, and it is absolutely entertaining and just it's cool. But before I tell you the story, I need to kind of fast forward a little bit, because after that Sunday, I forgot their names. And I just, oh man, it's such a cool story, and I really wanted to ask them for permission to share it, but I didn't know what their names were or how to get a hold of them and all that. And I kept looking, and I didn't, you know, that's a big place to kind of find people. So I just never saw them again. So we just kind of went on with life, and I kind of hadn't forgotten about the story, but thought I didn't know if they were still coming or not. 2 weeks ago, about, I was at one of my favorite little study spots, a little place called Beans and Cream in Cedarville, Ohio, a little coffee shop. And so I was there and walked in and was going to set my laptop down. In fact, started to make some work on this particular message. And I saw a gal, actually two gals, sitting at a table. And one of them kind of looked familiar, and she looked at me. And I'm not into walking up to, especially ladies, and say, do we know each other? It's just a little weird and creepy. So I was trying to be respectful, even though she did look a little familiar. So I sat down and began my studying. And it wasn't long until I felt kind of a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and it was this gal, this lady. And she reintroduced herself to me, said, my name is Libby Charlton. And we talked back in February of 2013. And then she began to tell us, I said, yes, I've been wondering where, you know, how we lost contact, and they're still coming. Well, this is their story. So they've been looking for a church. Aaron had been doing some of the research and been doing online stuff and asking friends and neighbors and all that. And finally, they actually found Southbrook online. And so they said, well, this is kind of a cool church. Let's check it out. So they came then in that February of 2013, and it just happened to be Super Bowl Sunday. And so they're standing in the atrium, and they're kind of not sure what was going on. This is a kind of a crazy place on Super Bowl weekend. They're just kind of watching everything happening, a little intimidated by the whole thing. And somebody walks up and says, do you want to participate? And Aaron, before Libby could even kind of hold him back, said, sure, not knowing what participate meant. Next thing you know, they're walking down a hallway and back through a room in a church they'd never been in before. And next thing you know, they're out on stage, and they're asked to participate in these bleachers. So they became a part. Well, here's how Libby tells the story. She identifies herself as a type A personality. She says, I'm bucking the whole time, and my anxiety of being in control was rising. Here we are in church. In church attire, not in Super Bowl attire, carrying our Bibles, not blowhorns. I was not happy, to say the least, with my husband's encouragement to just go with it. But we went with it. We sat in the bleachers the entire service, our first service at Southbrook, with a bunch of teenagers and foam fingers and a huge face of Charlie right behind us. Now that's Aaron circled. Libby, you can't see her. I think she's on the floor. So she said, we enjoyed the atmosphere, came back the next week to see what a real service might look like, and we have stayed ever since. We love Charlie's teaching and leadership, as well as many of the other regulars on stage. That's probably where I fit in as a regular. My husband can relate to Charlie and his down-to-earth style, which is important, and we love the worship. We've stayed because we feel the strong teaching, practical application is what we both need in our walks as individuals and as a couple. I've become involved with a women's ministry, another opportunity for me to grow and lead. Aaron loves the many opportunities we have to get involved in different ways, individually or with the family. We love the fact that Southbrook is a great place to invite our skeptic friends and to grow our future family. That's Aaron and Libby. Now, I share that story with you in this particular series because it just so affirms the freedom that we're talking about in the series on how to lose your religion. That even as a church, we can experience this freedom of doing things that are really kind of odd or out of the box or radical in order to accomplish our vision of helping de-church skeptics learn to live like Jesus. And that church is not this stuffy, boring, predictable place that things can happen just like Super Bowl weekend. In fact, Paul begins this text that we're going to read here today in Galatians 5. He says this. He says, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. I don't think Paul's use of the word, the redundant use of the word freedom and free is accidental. He said, this is why Jesus came. This is his whole mission, to set captives free, that we might experience this freedom, and that's why he came, is so that we might truly experience this freedom. There's three different pictures that I want you to kind of remember through this teaching here today, and here's the first one. The first one is to stand firm, and that verse says, stand firm and don't, again, let yourself be burdened by this yoke of slavery. The idea is to hold on tight, because freedom is somewhat elusive, as we all know. It's like we experience what we think is free relationship. Next thing you know, we've kind of lost it. It's kind of like the chasing the rabbit. It's elusive. And so Paul says, you need to stand firm and hold tightly to this freedom because it's elusive. In fact, the whole history of the Old Testament, the people of Israel, they were in slavery and bondage, out. God was leading them out. They were back in and out all the time, back and forth. It was that elusive. And we experienced the same thing. So stand firm, Paul says. There is a way to live that kind of gets us past this self-absorption. There is a way to live where we don't have to experience and live with narcissism. There is a way to live, and that way of life is the way that Jesus lived. And it's the way his disciples, all of his Christ followers lived. He wants us to experience that kind of freedom. And so we're invited not only to stand underneath this amazing waterfall of God's grace and his mercy, but we're also liberated. I mean, set free from shame and guilt and judgment and anything and everything that holds us back to being the real you that God wants you to be. Paul continues on. I'm going to just highlight a few of these verses. They're in your programs. We're going to kind of work down through this whole text here in Galatians 5. But look what he says next. So I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the works of the flesh. Now here's the second picture. The first one is to stand firm. The second one is to walk. And the word walk means it's actually a combination of two words, peri meaning around, and then the word for walk, which means to tread. So to tread around or to circle around, stay close to. Walk, stay close to the Spirit, and you will not gratify the works of the flesh. I think the order in which Paul says this is very significant. For example, he doesn't reverse it and say, if you'll just stop gratifying the works of the flesh, you'll walk by the Spirit. That's sin management. That's what we talk about all the time. And that's what, unfortunately, many of us have experienced in our long history of religiosity is we've been in situations where we're told, if you just don't do this, don't do this, and the list of don'ts. Jewish rabbis were told that they had a list of there's like 400 or 614 rules just in the books of Moses. And 365 of them were thou shalt nots. That number ring a bell? Think about it. Every single day you could focus on don't do this. You could live your entire life just focusing upon what we're not supposed to do. And so the fours, F-O-R-S, the fours of the gospel are totally ambushed and covered up by this massive pile of don'ts or against. And unfortunately, many people live their whole lives like that. Just trying not to do the don'ts and the shalt, thou shalt nots. And forget about what really this is all about. So Paul says, because of that, for the flesh desires what is contrary or opposite to the spirit, and the spirit what is contrary or opposite to the flesh. They are in conflict with each other so that you do not do what you want. Paul also talks about this in the 7th chapter of Romans, which is very similar to the book of Galatians. And this whole 7th chapter, Paul just, he just bears it out of this tug of war that he's experiencing that you and I can relate with. He says, the things I know that I should do, I don't do. And the things I know I shouldn't do, those I do. And finally, after a lot of this kind of ranting, he says, who shall deliver me from this body of death, this tug of war, this constant turmoil that I feel inside of what I should do and what I shouldn't do? We've all felt that way, haven't we? When I was going through kind of adolescence, I remember this very clearly. I remember this battle. I was a normal kid. There wasn't really anything weird about me, but I didn't know that at the time. I thought a lot of my feelings were weird because I just didn't know. And I remember hearing sermons about them in church, and I come home and I knew that there was all this. I didn't understand it was being, you know, a testosterone and adrenaline all kind of mixing up and kind of going all through my system. I just knew I had these weird, these thoughts that I thought, man, I shouldn't be thinking these. And I remember thinking very clearly, man, I can't get these into control. Maybe when I get older, I become a pastor. That would help. Wrong. Brennan Manning tells this story in the classic book, The Ragamuffin Gospel. He tells a story about a 92-year-old retired priest who lived in this very small community, deeply, deeply respected and revered by everyone in the community. They just loved him. He was just such a godly, saintly man. And he was also a member of the Rotary. So he would attend the Rotary meetings every month. Every month he was there, never missed, always sat in the same seat back in the corner. And you could just count on him being there. One meeting, he wasn't there. And everyone, that was odd because he just was always there. And so they begin to ask, where is he? And they begin to check around. And, of course, there's no family there. But they looked at his house, and no one knew. It's just like he vanished. And so they kept looking. Well, finally, the next meeting came along a month later, and he's back at the meeting. And so they go up to him. A couple of guys says, Father, you know, where have you been? We've missed you. We were really worried about you. He said, well, I'm kind of embarrassed. He said, but it's a long story, but let me simplify it by saying I've spent the last 30 days in jail. Jail? That is so... There's no way. I mean, you couldn't hurt a fly. What did you do that you spent 30 days in jail? He said, well, here's the story. He said, I bought a bus ticket to go into town. I just wanted to spend the day in the city. And so I went in there, and as I was getting ready to come back, I was standing at the bus stop, and this very beautiful, stunning woman walked up to me with a policeman and pointed at me and said, he's the man. He did it. And he said, to be honest, I was so flattered I pled guilty. I mean, there is this tug of war, isn't there? And you know it, and I know it. And like, how do we get our handle on this? How can we live a life that I know Christ wants us to live? We're just human battlefields, this raging war inside of us. And we understand the redemption doesn't just completely annihilate our depravity, our human, our fleshly nature. But on the other hand, we understand that God's given us an answer that can overpower this. We can crucify these things to flesh. So Paul lists in verse 19 these works of the flesh. He says they're obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, These are all sexual offenses. Idolatry, witchcraft, these are offenses towards God. Maybe some of, there's jealousy, discord, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, faction. If you felt like you were doing okay in the first part, now we're all hit. And then he even concludes by saying, and the like. So if nothing hit you before, the and the like will get you. I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this, which is a continual, habitual kind of a pattern in life, will not inherit the kingdom of God. So what do we do about this? Is this just like this checklist? Well, I've got a couple items here to maybe illustrate, I think, this whole principle. One is I borrowed my son-in-law's tool belt. It's pretty dusty, drywall all over it, dust. But it kind of gives you the idea. A tool belt exemplifies the idea of work and labor. So we could either imagine our life and all the things that could potentially go wrong, all the evil things, all these works of the flesh, which that's what they are. They're acts or works of the flesh, which implies that if you're gonna defeat them, you have to work at it and you have to fix them. I've always loved Fords. I know we got probably Chevy and Dodge and all that, but I've always been a Ford lover, but I never liked the fix or repair daily kind of acronym for Ford. But this idea is fix and repair daily, because all these works of the flesh, if you're going to conquer them, if you're going to manage them, then you need to work on them every single day, and you have to fix them all the time because they break. They keep breaking and falling down. So you have a choice. We all have a choice. We can either live our life basically like this and just basically try to keep modifying our behavior, keep managing our sin, keep checking off the things so that we keep not doing all those negative things, and we can live our entire lives just trying to manage our sin, which is going to be a constant work, constant effort, constant fixing, constant repairing, and it's going to get frustrating, and that's what this whole idea of slavery is all about. Do you really want to live like that? Is that how you want to spend the rest of your life? Just trying to fix everything? See, that's why a lot of people, that's the excuse I get from a lot of people as far as, well, I'm not going to get baptized yet because I'm not ready yet, because I still need to fix a few things. Well, how's that going to work for you? And when's that ever going to be done? Because it won't be. So that's one choice you can take, and those are the works of the flesh. But Paul says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. For those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. So there's a work or there's fruit. Anytime I've ever heard most messages about the fruits of the Spirit, or most Bible studies, always kind of depict them as like individual pieces of fruit, like VeggieTales. You've got kids, they probably know a little bit about VeggieTales. There's Larry the cucumber and Bob the tomato and Junior asparagus and Madame Blueberry and Petunia rhubarb. And I didn't know any of those other than Larry the cucumber. I had to look the rest of them up. But they're like individual. And that's okay. That's cool. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's good for us to kind of see what those characters look like as far as the qualities of our life and how they flesh out. But again, if you're looking at the fruits of the Spirit as a list of individuals' fruits, then guess what? We're just creating another list. Love is the first one. So start working on that. And you're going to keep working at it, right? And you might as well put the tool belt back on, because you're just going to keep working and working and working to try to be more loving, loving, loving. And you're not even going to get to the others, you know, the love, joy, peace. And maybe that's why we have such a lack of self-control, because this is the last one on the list. No one ever gets to self-control. So is that what he's saying? So we have to work for the fruits of the flesh? No. They're fruit, remember? So here's the other image. A cluster of grapes with one vine, one stem, one branch. And maybe that's more what Paul was trying to say. The fruit, singular, of the Spirit is the character of Jesus Christ, which happens to also be loving and joyful and peaceful and self-control. But that's all the character of Christ. Maybe another way to understand it is the theologically profound movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you remember one of the pieces of fruit there, he had, what do you call it? He said, the never-ending gobstopper. And the never-ending gobstopper was one piece of candy, but it had a never-ending array of flavors. So when you read the fruit of the Spirit, think of the never-ending gobstopper as the character of Jesus with an unlimited number of flavors. And it'll taste like love, and it'll taste like joy, and it'll taste like peace, and it'll taste like self-control. But it's the character of Christ. And so maybe that's the image. John 15, Jesus talks about the metaphor of the vine and the branch. And there he uses this metaphor and saying, as long as the vine is supplying the juice and the sustenance, as long as the branch is connected to the vine, it will bear fruit. It's the most natural and organic thing in the world. It's just because that's the nature of it. And so the idea of being a fruit bearer is not something you work at. It's not your objective in life is I need to bear fruit. No, your objective in life is to be connected to the vine. And when you're connected to the source of life through Christ, guess what? Christ then begins to provide growth, and he begins to provide fruit in your life. And it happens very natural, very organically, because that's the nature of Christ. That's what he wants to do. So Paul says, since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying one another. It's hard for us. Whenever I teach water sports, and by the way, June the 11th through the 14th is our water sports camp down at Butler Springs. If you have junior high or senior high kids that want to spend about 4 days and learn how to do all kinds of cool water sports. But whenever we teach basic water skiing, it's pretty interesting because it is so counterintuitive. And so what we usually do is we have the kids sit on dry land before we ever go out in the water, and they sit down, and I have a rope and a handle for them, and I teach them the basic position of how they are to sit and to be in ready to. But I say, let the boat do all the work. You don't pull yourself up. Let the boat pull you up. And I can always tell. As somebody, Don, you're shaking your head. I can always tell because you give them the handle, and I'm going to be the boat. And when I get to pull, almost invariably, you'll see them start to pull themselves. No, stop. Just keep your arms nice and straight with a little flex in the elbows and let the boat pull you up. And finally, I can tell when they are totally relaxed and let the boat pull them up. And that's this whole image of bearing fruit, is we let the vine provide the nourishment and the strength. And as long as we're tapped into him, he will grow the fruit. So he says, let us live by the Spirit. And keep in step. Here's the third phrase, third picture I want you to remember. The idea of keeping in step. The word there literally means to march. To march in formation. It implies discipline. And it also implies imitation. If we're going to keep in step, then we need to imitate. We need to follow. We're a Christ follower. So we learn to walk and see where the Spirit is going. And we keep in step with the Spirit. One of my favorite stories is of a young missionary intern that was going down to a Spanish-speaking country. And he was really, really weak in the Spanish language. And so but he really loved the Lord. He just really wanted to serve here. So he made his provisions. He got there. And the very first church, the very first Sunday, the very first church service, he was down there. He was late. He got kind of arrived late. So to be late in a Spanish-speaking community, you're really late. So he finally got there to the service. And the place was packed. And the only place for him to sit was right on the front row. You know, I know at Southbrook, whenever someone sits on the front row, they're not usually first-time guests. Because if you ever go to a church and you don't know what they're going to do, you always want to sit somewhere where you can see other people. So when they stand up, you stand up. When they sit down, you sit down. So you don't want to be embarrassed. So this guy was really nervous because he said, I don't know what I can't understand what they're saying. I don't know what they're doing. So and the only place left is on the front row. So he picked out a guy that he thought was a regular member of the church and said, well, I'll just guess whatever he does, I will do. So he just kind of worked that plan. So as they started singing some songs, whenever the guy would stand up, he would stand up. Whenever the guy would sit down, he'd sit down. And they got to the point where the guy was preaching. And so he was kind of kept his eye. They did communion, and he kind of followed to see if they took the emblems or if they walked up somewhere else. And so he did everything that the one guy did. It got to towards the end of the service, and it was like they were giving maybe some announcements. And so the pastor, the person up front, made this comment. And all of a sudden, the guy stands up, so he jumps up too. And then he hears this gasp. And he looks around, and no one else is standing up except for those two. So he immediately sits down. And after the service, he's talking to the missionary, the pastor there, who spoke English as well, and said, what happened there towards the end? He said, I didn't think you knew what was going on. And I said, no, I didn't. What did you say? And said, well, I just announced that the Rodriguez family had just had their first baby with a proud father. Please stand up. So be careful who you imitate. But this word means to imitate, to keep in step. Keep in step with the Spirit. Follow the Spirit's leading. And see where the Spirit leads. Now here's our final verse, and then we're going to conclude. Paul also says in Ephesians 2, he says, we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. I love this verse. God has created us. And when we're keeping in step with the Spirit, there is a plan. There is a mission involved. And we are created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. Jesus tells the story in Luke 10 about the Good Samaritan. And most of us know this story. Here's a guy that gets beaten up and just left by the side of the road. And there's other people who walk by him, and there's some religious people, some church people that walk by him, and they're too busy. You know, they have their own agenda, so they walk by and they ignore the guy until one unlikely guy, a Samaritan guy, comes up and he sees the man beaten up, and he stops and he takes care of him. He binds his wounds. He takes him to get some extended help and some care. He even picks up the tab and provides a plan where he'll come back and check on him later. And Jesus said, this guy got it. Now, the point of that whole parable, I think it's real simple, is we look for the good things to do. I can picture this guy who maybe didn't even know the Spirit of the Lord. But God said, I prepared this in advance for you to do. And you and I are the same way. Let me share one final story. His story was shared by John Ortberg, a pastor and author. It doesn't originate with him. It actually was a friend of his. I'm going to read it in the first person, and I'm telling you this up front so that I'm not trying to pull a Brian Williams or anything on you, but that was low, wasn't it? That was low. Listen to this story as stated by a friend of John Ortberg's. The state convalescent hospital is not a pleasant place. It's large and understaffed and overfilled with senile, helpless, and lonely people who are waiting to die. On the brightest of days, it seems dark inside and smells of sickness and stale urine. I went there once or twice a week for 4 years, but I never wanted to go there, and I always left with a sense of relief. It's not the kind of place that you get used to. This particular day, I was walking down a hallway where I was looking in vain for a few who were alive enough to receive a flower and some words of encouragement. This hallway seemed to contain some of the worst cases, strapped onto carts or wheelchairs, looking completely helpless. As I neared the end of the hallway, I saw an older woman strapped to a wheelchair. Her face was an absolute horror. The empty stare of the pupils of her eyes told me that she was probably blind. The large hearing aid over one ear told me that she was at best hard of hearing. One side of her face was eaten by cancer. There was a covered, pus-soaked covering over one cheek that had pushed her nose to one side and dropped one eye and distorted her jaw so that what should have been the corner of her mouth was really the bottom of her mouth. And as a consequence, she drooled constantly. I was told later that when new nurses arrived, the supervisors would send them to feed this woman, thinking that they could stand this sight, they could stand just about anything in this facility. I also learned that the woman was 89 years old and had been here bedridden, blind, and nearly deaf and alone for 25 years. This was Mabel. I don't know why I spoke to her. She seemed less likely to respond than most of the people in that hallway, but when I put a flower in her hand and said, "Here's a flower, Happy Mother's Day," she held the flower up to her face and she tried to smell it. And then she spoke, and to my surprise, her words, although somewhat garbled because of her deformity, were obviously produced by a clear mind. She said, "Thank you. It's lovely. But can I give it to someone else? I can't see, you know. I'm blind." I said, "Of course." And I pushed her chair down the hallway where we could find some alert patients. And I stopped the chair, and Mabel held out her flower and said to one lady, "Here, this is from Jesus." That's when it began to dawn on me that this was not some ordinary human being. Later, I wheeled her back to her room and learned more about her history. She'd grown up on a small farm that she had managed with only her mother until her mother died. Then she ran the farm alone until 1950, when her blindness and sickness sent her to this facility. For 25 years, she got weaker and sicker, and with constant headaches and backaches and stomach aches, and then cancer. Her three roommates were all incoherent, who screamed constantly but never talked. They often soiled the bedclothes, and because the facility was so understaffed, the stench was overpowering. Mabel and I became friends. I went to see her once or twice a week for the next 3 years. Her first words to me were usually the offer of some hard candy from a tissue box near her bed. Some days I would read to her from the Bible, and often when I would pause, she would continue reciting the passage from memory, word for word. Other days I would take a book of hymns and sing with her, and she would know all the words of the old songs. For Mabel, these were not some mere exercises of memory. She would often stop in mid-hymn and make a brief comment about the words she considered particularly relevant to her own situation. I never heard her speak of loneliness or pain. During 1 week of my final exams, I was frustrated because my mind seemed to be going in 10 different directions at once. And the question occurred to me, what does Mabel have to think about? Hour after hour, day after day, week after week, not even able to know if it's night or day. So I asked her one day, "Mabel, what do you think about when you lay there?" And she said, "I think about my Jesus." And I sat there and I thought about the difficulty I have of just thinking about Jesus for 5 minutes. And I said, "When you think about Jesus, what do you think about?" And she replied deliberately and slowly, "I think about how good he's been to me." You have to ask yourself, friends, is she monumentally deceived, or does she see truth that most of us never see? "I think about how good he's been to me. He's been awfully good to me, you know. I'm one of these kinds who's mostly satisfied. Lots of folk wouldn't care much for what I think, but I don't care. I would rather have Jesus. He's all the world to me." And then Mabel began to sing. "Jesus is all the world to me. My life, my joy, my all. He is my strength from day to day. Without him I would fall. When I am sad, to him I go. No other one can cheer me so. When I am sad, he makes me glad. He's my friend." Incredible as it may seem, this is not fiction. A human being really lived like this. I know. I knew her. Now I ask you, how does someone strapped to a chair or to a bed, unable to see, unable to hear a whole lot, and for the last 25 years, very few people even knowing she existed, how does a woman experience freedom and fruitfulness like that? The answer is the same as the answer for your life or mine. She knew him. She was connected. She knew how to stand firm and not allow the things in life to enslave her. She knew how to walk around the Spirit and to keep in step with the works of God in her life. And so today, may you and I receive some of the fruit of Mabel's life. And may it nourish you and strengthen you and empower you. In Jesus' name. And all God's people said, Amen. Have a great weekend.